G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Evan is with us, Evan Pavanka, community manager. He's here to ask me questions, to throw around some ideas about what's going on in the world, to basically be the conduit for you, the people. Hello, Evan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You couldn't put on a tie today.
No, yeah, not
last
today.
Last time you were here, you were wearing a bad jacket and a cheap. You looked like you were going to. You looked like a 13-year-old at a bar mitzvah last
Thank
time.
You.
Now you've just got a baseball cap on backwards, like you're trying to be Beavis and Butthead.
Is that a thing? Is that not cool in your part of the world to wear a backwards hat? Is that?
It's not cool in any part of the world, Evan. This has not been cool in any part of the world since 1992.
Is it just time for me to grow up, Peter Pan, and start?
It's time, like, yeah, for you to grow up, Peter Pan. We got questions coming in along the transom. Not sure what a transom is, but they're coming in there anyway. We got questions about some of the episodes from some recent episodes about things that are going on in the world, and I also have a few things that are going on in the world that are a little more upbeat that I wanted to share with people.
Good.
So I just wanted to set the stage for that, Evan. Shall I give you one thing that's not upbeat? First, and then we can just get it out of the way.
Yeah, what if this is like...
It's amusing, though. It's entertaining.
This is like Family Feud. Like, I have one, too, that I really want to talk about. So what if we pick the same one?
Oh, is
Wouldn't
there?
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Okay, well, you do you first.
Okay.
You do you.
I read a fascinating article yesterday about Ozempic zombies. Do you... does that mean anything to you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Talk.
So the article... You know Ozempic, obviously.
We are familiar with it.
So... Basically, they're starting to see that people who are on it, I don't understand exactly what it does, but it blocks the receptors that give you the desire to eat food, right? I think is correct.
Okay.
But over time, people are losing their desire to basically do anything. People have quit drinking, gambling, quit every bad thing that they don't want to do, but they're also like... not interested in their kids anymore. They're like turning into just like shutting everything down kind of a thing. And
it does stop you from being addicted to things, right? So it's like, if it stops you from smoking and like drinking and gambling, then maybe if you like are also getting a buzz from playing with your kids.
Yeah.
It does that. But then again, I'm always skeptical about these studies because
Same. How
many people are we talking about in comparison to how many people take Ozempic?
Right.
It's like, you know, every single person in America is on Ozempic. So if there are 100 people who turned into zombies, you know, they might have eaten a cashew and turned into a zombie.
Sure.
And then we'd be like, there's a cashew epidemic.
Yeah. But I think, who knows if this article, you know, what the data actually is on this. But it did get me thinking about, because I talk to my kids a lot about this. As you know, I quit drinking like 7 years ago, and I'm not sure where you're at on that. But
I'm still off it. I was at an event last night and talking to a fan about it. Someone came up to me and was like, "Oh, I'm a fan of the show," and obviously they weren't so much of a fan of the show that they knew that I didn't drink because they offered me a beer. And then we got to talking about that, and he was always like, "Oh, you know, I wish I was there as well, but like, what would I do in social situations?" And I remembered Anthony Robbins, you know, the great Anthony Robbins,
Tony.
Life coach.
Yeah.
Remember? Tony, the Tonester. I remember him talking to this dude saying that he was at a dinner with like a very rich and famous and powerful person who was hosting the dinner. And everyone was drinking wine except for Tony, who doesn't drink. And then afterwards, Tony was like, you know, he was like, "Oh, I wish I didn't drink. I really hate the fact that I still drink." And Tony was like, "You know, why don't you just stop?" And he was like, "Well, I mean, what about when I'm in a party and everyone else is drinking, or I'm hosting a dinner and everyone else is drinking?" And Tony Robbins looked at him and said, "Oh, I thought you were a leader."
Oh, ooh. Burn.
Which is a good retort.
Yeah.
A good burn.
Sick burn. Tony Robbins coming in hot.
I said that to this guy who came, this fan who came up to me at the function, and then he slinked away.
Well,
I didn't see him.
But it does kind of get to the point about the Ozempic zombies, and I'm not judging anybody if you want to do whatever, but it's like, I wonder if I could.
If you want to be a zombie.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's going to turn you into a zombie. Here we go. Like, now
we don't
get
have anything against zombies either.
No, zombies are people too, or were people.
Zombies were once people, and now they're the living dead, which is fine. I respect their identity.
I agree, but
I respect everyone's identity.
You know, if you could have just taken a shot or a pill to quit drinking, it does kind of feel like that would be different for some reason. I don't know why.
Oh, but I'm cool with it as long as it. But no, there is a pill. There is such a pill.
Right, that makes.
Katie Herzog wrote a book about it.
Yeah, it makes you sick. Naltrexone. Right. But it just got.
No. There's one that makes you. You see, now, oh, Evan, God. We had a conversation about this on this very damn podcast.
I think you and I even.
Not.
It's different than the one that makes
you
sick.
Did.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Yes, there's one that's been around for a long time that when you consume alcohol, it makes you feel nauseous and flushed. And in fact, I think it works the same way as like the gene that a lot of Asian people have. You know how a lot of Asian people get like kind of hot and flushed. If they drink, it's the same kind of phenomenon. And that has been one way of doing it, but it still doesn't remove the desire to drink, and it doesn't remove the high of the drinking. It just like adds on this extra layer of disincentive. But what naltrexone does is it screws with the dopamine pathways in such a way. It also, by the way, stops opioids from having an effect. So if you're taking naltrexone, you have to have a card in your wallet that says, if I'm hit by a car or in an accident and taken into the emergency room and I'm out cold, be aware that I'm on naltrexone. So if you give me morphine and then try to cut me open,
it's
going to be very painful. It's going to hurt. And so what it does is like you just don't want the drink because it still gives you the fogginess and the uncoordination and discombobulation, but it doesn't give you any kind of a pleasure.
Right.
And that's fine. That works for people.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
But just as long as it doesn't turn them into the living dead.
Right.
As long as they don't, you know, adopt a taste for human flesh and wander around late at night.
Are you
digging up graves?
Are you a zombie guy? Do you like zombie movies, Josh?
Yeah, I do. I am partial to a zombie. I like my zombies fast. I don't like my, you know, that was the great contribution of the Living Dead. Walking Dead.
The show,
They were fast.
Yeah, they were fast.
The show, they were fast zombies.
But
I don't like the arms out, walking along, shuffling along slowly.
Shaun of the Dead, very good though, and very funny. They're slow.
Shaun of the Dead.
They're kind of slow.
Also. Slow, yeah.
But World War Z, too fast. Too fast.
Right.
Because there are waves of them, and they're just mowing them down. Brad Pitt. You know, I want to see fast enough to catch you. Anyway, that wasn't my point. The point was just, have you ever seen the movie The Jerk with Steve Martin?
Well, of course. Have I seen it? It's a timeless classic.
But this is like where my mind always goes with things like Ozempic and whatever are fads, is that it'll turn out in 6 months or a year to like make everybody's hair fall out or something that we don't understand or make everybody go cross-eyed.
I mean, that's right.
You know?
Or it'll just do what it does, which is like make your body kind of atrophy.
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be consequences of having low. I mean, we know it decreases your bone density and decreases your muscle mass quite dramatically. So
I just get nervous when consequences
of that we don't really
there's
know.
That much money to be made by these things. I just get nervous, I guess, behind it. But anyway, that's.
And also when they're rolled out without any like broader context about wellness, like say what you want about RFK Jr. But I mean, at least I think the man has a misguided, but nonetheless noble conception of health as being holistic in some way. And it not just being let's shove everybody full of fast food and, you know, industrialized factory farming and then give them a pill to stop the effects of the terrible shit that they're putting in their body.
Right. Yeah, no bueno on that. Well, speaking of infectious diseases, somebody in the Substack wants you to talk about the way you think about risk management with COVID. Is that something you actually want to revisit?
Oh, I saw that.
Again, I'm not going to be a big sycophant here, just telling you how great your episodes have been lately. But I did enjoy the Turning Points Australia conversation, and I think a lot of people did.
This was a conversation with the head of Turning Point in Australia, the Charlie Kirk Turning Point USA, but the Australian
version
offshoot of it.
Yeah.
And he came to fame or notoriety during COVID, where he was a big anti-lockdown champion. And yes, I was sent this comment as well from JT saying, I don't know if this is the one that you're talking about or if there was another one.
It is.
We get a few.
Yep, I think.
I feel Josh just can't admit or can't understand the difference between relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction when it comes to COVID. At least he can now admit that the mandate measures were, quote unquote silly. Yeah, those violations of civil liberties and bodily autonomy were so silly. So taking a pot shot at me, I guess, for maybe I called them silly in their excesses. Firstly, to say that I'm a Johnny come lately who's only admitting it now is belied by the fact that in November of 2021, I wrote an article that got me in a lot of trouble in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age saying, can we start having a rational conversation about how we're dealing with the pandemic? Because that was at a stage at which basically everybody was vaccinated, but it was still taboo to talk about easing up, about totally abolishing the final restrictions on interstate travel and so on and so forth. People misunderstand the epidemiology and the economics of pandemics still. It's not that I don't understand the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. It's that if you're going to try to eliminate community spread of a pathogen, then you sort of have to go all or nothing. The worst case scenario is what places like the UK did. And I think it was not dissimilar in places like California, where you sort of try to do a bit and then you say, actually, this isn't working. It's too hard. So let's let it rip. And then for a while, and then you realize that the health system is overwhelmed. And then you bring in some new rule. And then it's the unpredictability and the fecklessness that is the real pain. It's also the fact that the economic consequences of nobody wanting to go out and, you know, have coffee with a friend if it means that they might spend the next 2 weeks in bed with a terrible flu means that the economy doesn't recover as fast as it might. The Australian approach was, we have the opportunity, if we move fast enough, to restore normality throughout the duration of the pandemic until everybody can get vaccinated. And that essentially worked. The borders were closed and the state borders were closed. And for a majority of Australians, they lived in the 4 out of the 6 states that completely eradicated COVID pretty quickly and then basically lived perfectly normal lives. I mean, for a long time, that was even the case in Sydney. I remember posting, I went to see Hamilton in a huge theater in early 2021, and I was posting it to Instagram, and there was no social distancing. We were all sitting next to each other. We were masked, but we were all sitting next to each other. And my American friends were like, oh my God, this is giving me an anxiety attack just even looking at this, because they were a year into cowering inside because, the initial phases of the pandemic had been mismanaged, and there are all other kinds of reasons why it's more difficult for a country like the United States to enact a swift border closure than it is for an island nation like Australia. So the idea is that, and Australia fumbled the vaccine rollout, which then meant that long after other countries had already begun opening up and being vaccinated, we were still swanning along in our blind state of bliss and ignorance. And this is all with the exception of Melbourne and Victoria, which had a different experience, and that's its own thing. And that's where Jamal, my guest, was, and that's where most of the radical libertarian anti-COVID lockdown activism was happening with some justification. But for people to understand what the rationale was behind it, it then became a question of, okay, well, the vaccines are now here, and it wasn't Omicron. What came before Omicron?
Delta.
Delta upended all of the epidemiological assumptions that the public health departments had been working on. And so all of a sudden, the normal ways that they would contain small outbreaks from the quarantine hotels that were allowing Australians back into the country no longer worked because it was so much more infectious. There was an outbreak, and then it was like, all right, what do we do with the final 90 to 100 days? Do we allow it to rip and hope that we don't become Northern Italy or New York City in March of 2020? Or do we stay home and wait until we're all vaccinated and then let it rip? And the decision was made to stay home and get vaccinated, and that was an incredibly popular decision. So I'm sorry that people who dissented from that decision had to abide by the supposed human rights violations of the rest of us, but Australia's fatality rate was 90% lower than the United States per capita. There was hardship. I mean, you know, pandemics suck. So you just have to choose your version of suckiness in a way. And Australia never went down the path of of long school closures, for example, and most of the population was able to continue going to work and continue going to school for the majority of the pandemic. So relative risk versus absolute risk is, I think, the wrong framing. I'm not saying that you should do everything that you can in order to eliminate any risk of dying of COVID. I'm saying that when you're choosing which version of the spread of a pandemic to select, there is a good case to be made for going very hard, very quickly, and then reaping the benefits rather than eking it out over time. I don't think anyone, certainly not me, is saying that you should absolutely eliminate the risk.
Right. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. All said. But I subverted you. You said you had a funny thing.
Yeah, I had a maybe not funny. Oh, Matthew says in the chat that his company makes naltrexone.
Oh, cool.
That's interesting, Matthew. Tell me more.
Yeah.
Tell me
more. Come on, Matthew. Why am I here?
So my maybe not. Why are you here? Why is Evan here? Evan, everybody. Yeah. Evan Pavanka, community manager. He works 90 hours a week. 90 hours a week, as well as being a university professor, works 90 hours a week on this show.
Also, you'd be happy to know.
Translating all of the things.
Little League is back up. We had our first game last night, so you'll be losing me to baseball as well. No. Again.
Okay, great. Fabulous. Makes my life a lot more difficult. So here's the piece of news that came across my desk. Traders made $832 million in oil bets just before Trump's social media post about Iran talks.
Love it.
So traders made bets worth $500 million in the oil market about 15 minutes before Donald Trump's post touting quote-unquote productive talks with Iran sent the price of crude tumbling and ignited volatility in other assets. Trump's announcement at 7.04 a.m. triggered a sharp sell-off across global energy markets and jumps in S&P 500 stock index futures and European equities as investors dialed back bets of a prolonged conflict. The well-timed trades echoed the flurry of largely highly profitable bets made on the prediction market Polymarket on the timing of the U.S.'s attacks in recent months on Iran and Venezuela. White House spokesperson Kush Desai said, quote, "The only focus of President Trump and Trump administration officials is doing what's best for the American people." He added, "The White House does not tolerate any administration official illegally profiteering off insider knowledge, and any implication that officials are engaged in such activity without evidence is baseless and irresponsible reporting." However, the piece goes on to say several hedge funds noted that this was one of a number of examples in recent months of large trades being made ahead of official U.S. government announcements. One trader at a major hedge fund said energy consultants had recently noticed several large block trades that they found to be unusually timed. Quote, "My gut from watching markets for the last 25 years is this is really abnormal," he added. Quote, "It's Monday morning. There's no important data today. There aren't any Fed speakers you'd want to front run. It's an unusually large trade for a day with no event risk. Somebody just got a lot richer."
And then that guy added at the end, "And today will be my last day working for the Trump administration. You can find me on a ginormous yacht in the Mediterranean from here on out."
No, that was a hedge.
No, the guy before.
Oh, the guy before. Yeah. So that's nice. So 15 minutes before the announcement that Trump was looking to end the war, bunch of people bet that the oil price would go down, and they made a lot of money from it. So good for them.
Yeah. What a mess.
Feel free to ask us any questions on the Substack. We'll get to it. Evan Pavanka is with us, the community manager. I'm just looking through your chats right now, Evan. We have some other questions that have come in from viewers, but is there anything that you want to flag? I'm going to give the floor to you.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, I had a general observation that kind of spans a few of the recent episodes talking about housing policy and, you know, high density, low density housing, community, you know, urban planning stuff, diversity in communities, whatever. And correct me, but every time I hear these conversations about institutional changes that can be made, whatever, I kind of roll my eyes a bit because I really feel like it doesn't matter how we lay neighborhoods out if we don't start actually, you know, like talking to each other and like actually engaging. Do you know what I mean? It's like my...
You mean IRL? Do you mean in real life? Or do you mean on the interwebs?
Yes, I mean IRL. Like I live in
How do you do that if you live in a suburban area? How low density is your area? I'm imagining bucolic.
Well, now, fields. As I said, I'm up on our 80 acres. There's no one in sight. So I don't have anybody to hang out with. Right. But our normal...
So how is the IRL conversing going on those 80 acres?
Chatted with my neighbor about the frogs coming out of the pond the other night.
Yeah. What do you have to walk 40 acres? See 40
something like that.
I don't know what
it's coming up the driveway.
I don't know what an acre
is. But, I guess my point is like, at the end of the day, the value of community lies with engagement and conversation and getting together. Disclosure, I'm teaching Tocqueville right now in my class, so this is always like...
You never haven't been teaching Tocqueville. You're always pulling Tocqueville from under your stupid backward baseball cap.
Like it
makes
it
you some
forward.
Sort of fancy hoity-toity.
He's the best. Professor. He's the best, Josh. He is the best observer of what could be wrong with democracy.
America.
Well, democracy in general, I think, which is... that you need associations, you need clubs to be a part of and people to get together in real life and talk about problems and talk about their lives so they can understand each other. And whether you're in a leafy suburban neighborhood or a urban high rise, if you're not actually doing shit with your neighbors, I just don't think it really matters. And I think at the end of the day...
Yeah, but that sounds to me, Evan, like something that someone who has only lived in suburbia says. Have you lived in a big city, urban city?
Yeah, I lived in Vancouver for a while.
Not a city.
What?
Next.
What? Vancouver?
Not a city.
Get out of here.
I'm teasing
okay,
you.
I hope we hear it in the chat.
Vancouver's fine. I'm sure Vancouver
rise up.
Vancouver's lovely.
Don't let Josh talk shit about
it. Everyone says Vancouver is lovely.
Beautiful.
Yep.
But I lived
there's a lot of heroin addicts and a lot of rain.
That's only in Gastown. That's only in Gastown.
Vancouver is fabulous. No, I love our Canadian friends. For me, Toronto is the better city because it's more of a city. You know what I mean? Vancouver's more spread out. Evan's just shaking his head.
I'm disappointed.
And his arms
are
crossed in a very defensive. Looks very defensive.
I can't believe I'm defending Vancouver. I didn't like it that much, but now.
Me neither. Me neither.
Well, okay, but what's your point?
Here's the thing. There are a couple of benefits to high density living that I have found. One is true, which is what you're saying, which is like, you know, yes, make a proactive attempt to have real life conversations with your neighbors, have the potluck, you know, have the bingo,
yeah.
Have the, you know, the grown-ups come over and drop their keys in a goldfish bowl and you go home with your neighbor's spouse, whatever you want to do.
No judgment.
Whatever
Let's
floats
not
your
yucca,
boat.
Yum.
The mud wrestling competitions in the backyard, whatever you want to do. There's all that. But then one thing that big, very high-density urban centers have that I like is just all of the incidental human-to-human contact that you can't avoid. Because you're just walking down a street that's full of hundreds of other people and every place that you go into has lots of other people. And so there are constant... The sociologists have a word for these kinds of relationships. I can't remember what it is, but it's like people who are definitely not friends and kind of maybe acquaintances, but they just sort of form the scaffolding of the rest of your life in a human community. Mm-hmm. And that's what you can't get from suburbia, even if you're doing a good job at building community. I'm not saying everyone needs that. I'm partial to it, but you're right. You can manufacture human connection even in a sprawling suburb, but you can't manufacture walking down the street and having to step over a homeless person at the same time as a billionaire drives by in a limousine and, you know, the smell of shawarma comes off the Middle Eastern halal food stand and the Hasidic Jews are walking past.
Love it.
That's like something that only happens in big cities, which I really love. The melting pot.
I'm with you 100%. I love time spent in cities. I'm with you. But my experience, I guess, is still that, or my take, I guess, is that it, like, Ashley and I were in New York for the U.S. Open this last fall. We stayed right downtown, you know, at the Standard or whatever. And it's like, you still, we walked a bunch, but everybody's just on their phones. You go into the local coffee shop. No one talks. You don't even have to talk to the barista anymore. You just order it on your phone and go grab it, whatever. I guess my point is just that we can talk about structural changes all we want. But at the end of the day, I think underneath that and more important, we need to revisit creative ways to actually like sit down and, you know, talk to each other. And that's, yes, in fact, much more important. And I would, you know, you've read Bowling Alone, the Robert Putnam book.
Yeah, that's right. When it first came out, 7 million years
ago. Yeah. So at the time he was saying that television is going to ruin democracy, you know, because everybody's just going to stay in their homes instead of biking in the cul-de-sac with their kids after dinner or whatever, and talking to the neighbors. And, you know, now obviously iPhones and the internet are a whole different thing. And, you know, I think a suburban setting where, I'm not saying we should have and I think this happens somewhere in some town where they like have an internet blackout after 8 p.m. or something like that. Maybe I'm making that up. That was just China. A fever dream.
I think China switches off its social media app after like 9 p.m. Okay.
But
for kids, at least.
Yeah. But do you know what I'm saying?
I think there are different, like, because I think what you're alluding to is the conversation that we had with
Eamon.
The chairman of the city, of the committee for Sydney, who like studies what makes cities work. Right. I think the episode, what was the episode called? Like how cities.
No, it was like Mr. Mamdani, like this is how you run a city or something.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yes, that's right. Mr. Mamdani, this is how you make a city thrive. So there's the incidental interactions that, as you say, can be unfulfilling because maybe you just use the app to order your coffee instead of having a chat to the barista anyway, although I would encourage people to have a chat to the barista.
Agreed.
You remember that study? Remember that study about where they got college students to strike up conversations with people on the subway?
Yeah.
You remember this? Yeah. They had to chart their happiness. It was part of the, you know.
Perfect.
And nobody wanted to do it in advance. They thought it would be terrible.
And then
after a week or two of daily making conversations with strangers on the subway, the control group that wasn't doing that was considerably less happy than the group that had been doing it, even though it's kind of scary to begin with. So there's that.
Yeah.
And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's what you're talking about, which is building communities in regardless of where they are, even if they're in suburbs where people come over and you can talk and you can get into the serious stuff and you can flesh out ideas and whatever. What I'm a big fan of, maybe because I grew up in medium density and now I live in medium density, I've moved back from low density suburbia to medium density, is maybe something in between that I haven't really thought of trying to articulate before, but like, it's not like living in Manhattan where there's total cacophony, but it is dense enough that you can walk to the local park and probably the parent of a kid who you know is there with their kid playing in the playground and you incidentally chat about nothing terribly important. Right. Or you can go to the local bowling club, which is like a kind of a Timu bar, sure, that Australia has, and you know, you can hang out and have a beer and there'll be other people who you're sort of tangentially familiar with who are there. I think that's good. It definitely feels different just to be able to, you know, hang out, just, you know, the end of school, you're like, oh, dude, you know, does your kid want to come over and have a play date?
Right.
Sure. It's not so far away that we're going to have to drive 20 minutes through the suburbs to get there or something.
Yeah. Or even just like the corner. Show up to somebody's house. I mean, it's so offensive. You know, can you imagine if like,
I mean,
somebody just like,
isn't it?
Like showed up and was
just
like,
knocked on your door?
Hey, what's up?
Like, what are you doing? I'm not a Jehovah's Witness. I didn't know you were.
Yeah. I mean, it's just sad that
we do that as kids. I used to just go over to my friend's place and knock on the door
all the time. And it was like, oh, what are you guys having for dinner? Yeah. Like, can you make me a plate?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Whatever. And now the thought of that is like, that's spooky.
It's so rude. I mean, yeah. I don't even think it's rude to call someone without texting them first. It's like, you know, you call, someone calls me. I'm like, well, I'm in the middle of something. I didn't plan for this.
Exactly.
I know what I'm doing for the next 15 minutes, and I wasn't going to be talking to you.
Right. Yeah. So
put me in your calendar.
My point is, like, I loved playing SimCity as a kid. Did you ever play that video game?
I didn't, but I know.
Yeah. Like, that's what it sounded like. You and Eamon were kind of, you know, like, move this here and put a park there and blah, blah, blah. And that's great. And we should do stuff like that and be thoughtful about the way we design urban spaces. But at the end of the day, I'd rather see, like, my university that I teach at, like, force students to leave their cell phone in a basket when they go into the dining hall or something.
Oh, definitely.
You know? And I think that would do more to actually change things for the good than, like, thinking and spending billions of dollars about how we're going to lay out the dorms so that people are more in contact with each other. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter because they're just on their phones.
I remember when I was living in New York City when the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, brought in mobile phone reception to the subway system. Oh man, your microphone is good enough that gulp. Was AMSR.
ASMR. Here we go.
It was like so sensuous. Oh man! Just when he was about to go, we lost him literally as he was about to take a beautiful, luscious gulp. G'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now, right now, right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for. Better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steel man our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.